We're on chapter 8. We haven't done this for a while. We haven't been here, so... Actually, it's not the chapter that I would have liked to start with. It's a little heavy one. It's one of the few places in Chassidus where, well, if you do this, you'll get this, if you do this, you'll get that. Now, Chassidus is always, in other walks of Jewish life, they're very into punishment, and you know, you better watch out, otherwise you'll get this. And you don't find that too often in Chassidus. But, now, I was thinking, should I skip it? And I said, no, there's a lot of fundamental here, important stuff. Besides that, so we'll just, you know, de-emphasize the negative. And, you know, it's also important to realize as well. Okay, let's start. We had spoken in chapters 6 and 7 that our world is basically a world of klipa. Klipa means the shell. And the other Kabbalistic term for evil is sitra achra, the other side. And we had said that those two terms are very significant in what do we mean when we speak about not getting involved in materialism? Why? So we said, klipa is the shell. Now, is the shell a bad thing?
No.
What?
It can
protect. No, it does. Oh. I mean, a fruit which doesn't have a shell, a nut that doesn't have a shell, it's not going to last very long. A shell is a very important element of existence. But, well, that's the problem.
Conceals.
Yeah, that's not because the shell is not visible. It conceals, but most important, if you take the shell for the fruit, you're in trouble. If you use the shell, as a protector, I need it, but as soon as I want the fruit, I'm going to cast it away. Shell's a very valuable, very useful thing. If you begin to think the shell is significant in its own right, then you got a problem. So, this is the Jewish conception of material existence. It's a shell for the inner godly spark that exists. Since we're living in a material world, that shell is necessary. Can't get away from it. On the other hand, to consider that shell as what's important, that doesn't want to go. That's the shell. Sitra Achra, the other side. Again, I keep, you know, revealing my age, but the guys who were in the 60s, remember, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. You weren't in the 60s. That's when the slogan was at least first coined recently. I don't know how far it goes back. But. So the other side means somebody who's not, or as the Alter Rebbe says there in chapter 6, something which is not given over to God, either potentially or an actual fact. So, again, is it bad? You know, we're not talking about the devil with the sinners and with his pitchfork and dressed in red. Just not part of the solution. As long as you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. That's, in other words, to get back to where we're holding, there are plenty of very nice people in very nice situations in the world. They're just not godly. It's not bad. They're just not godly. So if I can use them for a godly purpose, getting back to our shell idea, if somehow have these situations are the shell for a godly spark, good. If all I have is these situations, got a problem. More specifically, the Torah tells us that there's two types of people. Actually, four types, but in two general categories. There's what's called Kripa Snoga, the shining Kripa. There, the godliness which is there is accessible. This is kosher. I think, I hope you're just walking by an honest person, so I can hope that, that it's kosher. Made a bracha on it. I'm drinking it in order that it should give me power to serve God. I've elevated the godly spark of it. Well, you know, yeah, that's all elevate some sparks. That's a very, you know, that's a powerful thing. To take a physical entity and tap the godly spark that's there. That's possible in Kripa Snoga. Then there's three impure Kripa. There, that's what we're going to focus on in this chapter. There, the godly spark is inaccessible. There's no way, through ordinary means, that godly spark can be tapped, liberated, given expression. That's why they're called osur, forbidden. But as we'll see in a second, osur also has a different meaning. People, anybody here is good in Hebrew? What is the other meaning of osur?
Tied.
More specifically, bound. Like in chains and in chain. It's not that kosher is tied. Osur is like in fetters. These things, the godly sparks in these other in these entities which are shloshlofi tameis, which are forbidden by Torah law. Those godly sparks are fettered. There's no way you can ordinarily elevate them. They're bound, imprisoned, as it were, in the material nature of the world until they can be elevated either through tshuva or at the time of Mashiach's coming, which is in chapter 7. Let's look inside now in chapter 8. Another factor exists in regard to forbidden foods. Shlakach nikrim b'shem isur. Therefore they are called isur, forbidden. B'nei she'ach misha ochol maise isur b'lo hodal b'shem shemayim. Even if a person ate bidden food without knowing it was forbidden, b'shem shemayim, he ate it for the sake of God's name. In other words, somebody gave, he didn't know, he thought the food was kosher. And he ate it with the intent of serving God. Lavot Hashem b'koch achilahi, to serve God with the power he got from that food. Gam Paul we also came. And not only did he have that intent, he actually did so. The Korah v'spal b'koch achilahi, and he read Torah, and he davened with the power of this food. Still, ein chaya sheba ova mislabesh the tevas haTorah tzilik mo heter. The life energy which is in that food does not ascend and enclose itself in the words of the Torah and in the prayers as kosher food would. Because it's bound, because it's fettered in the hands of the Sitra Achra, the other side from the three impure people. But feel Yisro de Rabbanan, Shechamurim Devei Sofrim Yosem Devei Torah. This also applies even to a rabbinic prohibition, because the rabbinic prohibitions are more severe than the prohibitions of scriptural law. There's a couple of points here. And the simple types of the rabbinic prohibitions are more severe is that the rabbis were more stringent. Torah gives you this much. It says this is forbidden. Rabbi says put a fence around the Torah, and therefore they're more severe. Talmudically, and how much more so mystically, the expression takes on a deeper meaning. The sages were, when they forbade something, they recognized a deeper klipa than the Torah as it might be. It's a very interesting concept. In the, let's get a little mystical. When there's a revelation of divine light, it's easier to elevate material entities. We see godly light. When godly light is revealed, then you've got the wind behind your back. Any salesmen here?
Like
sailors? Yes. Got the wind behind your back. You can take, it's much easier to elevate material entities when godliness is revealed. So at the time of the temple, there weren't too many strictures. Very few of the stringencies, the oral law, existed in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. Definitely even in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, even the time of the second. Why? Because godliness was revealed. And so man had the potential to elevate material entities that were questionable in nature. Torah didn't forbid them because in a situation when godliness is revealed, they can be elevated. But what happens when godliness is not revealed? Then they cannot be elevated. On the contrary, that energy which exists in them will take man down.
I don't
quite get what you're saying.
Seems to be saying that the restriction that the Torah elucidates are only relevant that we can't handle, as it were, the darkness of Gullus.
Some of them can.
So what about the eternality of all of Torah?
So, again, halachically, basar v'chalav, milk and meat, forbidden according to scriptural law. Milk and fowl,
permitted
according to scriptural law. Rabbis say no. In milk and fowl is forbidden. Now, if the rabbis would say milk and fowl is forbidden according to scriptural law, that's Baal Tosi. You're adding to Torah, and to a certain extent, hence they're really like outside the entire realm of Torah. Rabbis aren't saying that. They're saying Torah law allows you, scriptural law allows you to eat milk and fowl. You are not able to elevate it. On the contrary, it's going to draw you down. They know the situation in the present time. The Torah is speaking about, in other words, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with milk and fowl. There's something wrong about milk and fowl in an era when godliness is not revealed. And therefore, the sages say, no, wait, we can't do it. Same thing, like, at Pesach, I told the guys, my father-in-law says the rabbis in heaven are like bowled over laughing, at all the chumras, all the stringencies we accept in Pesach. My father-in-law, he's absolutely convinced that they're just cracking up. Look at all these, what these guys are doing. And he's probably right. But they also probably, the rabbis are also probably very happy we're doing this. They're laughing, but they're nicely so. Now, you give me a second. That's the board. My down, according to my downstairs neighbor, eats rice and Pesach. We don't. Because, again, how it mixes place-wise, leaving off that one to today, though, that's also mystically involved. Yeah, Swami Maharaj, come from different, from different mystic environments and different mystic influences. But according to Ashkenazic tradition, there is no way to elevate rice on Pesach. Wait a second. 100 years ago, it was okay. Not 100, but now it's about, 800 years ago. It was okay. It was okay. Yes. They were more spiritually inclined. The world was in a higher place spiritually. It's okay. And every generation, as it goes on, has its own senses of stringency, stricture, because the rabbis are sensitive to the spiritual climate of the time. Some of them are sensitive intuitively. They know they're in touch with Kabbalistic things. Some of them, it's a subconscious thing. They don't really know the Kabbalah. They don't see the spiritual influences and what you can do spiritually. But subconsciously, they are in touch with it, and their subconscious is molding their conscious. The point the conscious says, you can't throw those matzah in the soup. Come on, it's nice, it tastes good. The matzah is terrible otherwise. Not really, but some of us, some. Yeah. In this case, the matzah is, it's a spiritually sensitive. This is the Tamidia Baal Shem, who were very into the masses. Not putting them in soup. But this, some people were other things, but it's, as you're in touch, either consciously or subconsciously, with the spiritual influences of the time, there are these hakdoras. You have something?
Yeah. So, can we say that the rabbi, the green something like what you said, like milk, chicken and milk, is only God's will that wanted to be revealed in the earlier generation, or and not earlier, but the later generation. So I kind of have a problem, and it's funny because my dad asked this question. So how is it that it could be? From the point of view, how do you come to that sort of church, so different wills, to say it like this, for the Ashkenazi, and as far as to the point that we come to interact with physicality so differently?
Let me leave that one for now, because different men hardly more, but there are, first of all, there's really not that much difference. The rice on taste, there's really not that much difference. Most of it is really small stuff. But it also has to do with the spiritual sensitivity that people have. And each community has its own spiritual sensitivities. Some of the afterwards just kind of gets, now you're perpetuating the tradition, and new rabbis will come up, and they are doing this. One of the questions now is, what do we do now that the traditions of the families are being mixed? But that's a whole separate issue. But this is something which I want to actually get into one more halachic dimension here. Let's actually go strict halachic. Have you guys heard the words gavra and chefsa?
No, it's
Gavra means the man. Chefsa means the article. The Rav Chaim Brisker, he was one of the great Rosh Yeshivas about two generations ago. One of his biggest, how should you put it, philosophy of halacha, if you can put it, look, you know, outlooks is a prohibition gavra or chefsa. What do we mean? Chometz. Is it osur to have chometz, or am I forbidden to have chometz? In other words, is the prohibition on the chometz itself, on the physical article, or is the prohibition upon me, the gavra, the man, that I can't have it? And you know, there are people who want to say the whole Torah is chefsa, people want to say the whole Torah is gavra, and in truth, if you're a Brisker, you're very careful. A gavra mitzvah, this is a chefsa mitzvah, you differentiate between some mitzvahs which are gavra and some mitzvahs which are chefsa. Chometz, for example, is clearly the article itself is osur. It's chefsa. Hachefetz, the article. Actually, the Rebbe actually brings us down. Is the people who say that even on chametz, the people who do it gavra chefsa. The opinion says chametz has to be burned to the point of ashes. No, that's chefsa. You have to destroy the article itself. But if you say that chametz is only on gavra, so you render the article useless. You crumble it and throw it in the wind. It still exists, but man can't use it. But you know, even that, when people say no, it's still a chefsa.
So that was coming from different opinions. If we want called chefsa, or
was, yeah, or that's what people want to go into, and they do this to the whole Torah. Now, yeah, again, you have to look through Brisker stuff, and it's kind of nice. I mean, it's one of the, you know, the abstract view of halacha. You know, the Rav Sheva has other dimensions of it, but you know, the Rebbe, here's one of the things where the Rebbe would just, if you see it, like walk through the whole Torah on these things, you know, give you tons of examples of gavra, chefsa, and chefsa. Anyway, one of the questions is a mitzvah derabbanan, a rabbinic commandment. Why do we say asher kiddushar b'mitzvosa v'tzivonu when we fulfill a rabbinic commandment? We wash our hands, right? In the Torah, before eating, before davening. According to scriptural law, is there a mitzvah to wash your hands?
No.
No. Why do we wash our hands? No. There's been a commandment. So how can we praise God for saying, Asher Kedushav Mitzvosa B'tzivonu, to wash our hands, but it's not a scriptural commandment. Rabbi so-and-so said, wash your hands. How can we praise God?
Can you tell us the next report anyway?
Are you getting there? Good. More specific.
For them, his will was revealed.
One of the scriptural commandments is Lo sorse medivrehem yamin u'smol. You should not swerve from their words, the words of the rabbis, left or right.
Wait, that's not their words as in words of Torah.
The rabbi's commandment. Whatever the rabbis say, the rabbis will tell you left is, the Gemara says further, the rabbis will tell you that left is right, now left is right. So, since God commanded you to keep the rabbi's commandments, and the rabbis told you to wash your hands, you're commanded by God to wash your hands, because you're commanded by God to fulfill the rabbi's commandment. Okay? Now, What is los oser? A gavra or a chesa? What is los oser? You shall not swerve.
Gavra,
obviously. You shall not serve. There's no chesa involved at all. It's all on you. So on the surface, this statement we offer up to here that the rabbinic commandments are shlosha klipos kameyas is very. That's the difficulty in it.
Why all of them? Why would they be exactly the same?
No, come on. Come on. Let's do this.
God's will is to be this.
If according to scriptural law they're permitted. So as a gavra, you are forbidden to use them. But the chepsa, on the surface, is permitted. How can the author have this say? In other words, it's the chepsa should be permitted, klipas noga, but you as a gavra are forbidden to use it. The author have isn't saying that. He's saying that the chepsa is forbidden. So there's a beautiful sikha from the Rebbe, which I tried to find, and I told somebody else, Rabbi Lichten, to look for it. Did you ever get some, because Rabbi Lichten is much better at this than I am. Like, he's like really good at Makoros. Yeah. The Rebbe spoke 3 weeks in a row on this subject. Wow. Because how can the rabbis, this is a big chiddush, that the rabbis can make an Isra Chefsa.
Sorry, Rabbi, can you say this again I
really
forget the terminology.
Chesed is the article, gavra is the person.
Okay.
Right? Now, if the rabbi, so what is the commandment to listen to the rabbis? Lo sosa midigrei, and you should not swerve from their words. Swerve. Turn away.
Ah, okay, yeah.
So what is that a command? In the person.
Gavra?
Yeah, gavra. Gavra. Now, suddenly we're saying that the articles themselves are forbidden. That thing? Hefsa. So the Rebbe has a whole, again, I've been looking for this. It's one of the it's one of the chidushim of the Rebbe substantiate the Alter Rebbe. I mean, that is word here. After Kabbalah, the Rebbe did it. The Rebbe had a whole pilpul and nigla to substantiate the statement after Kabbalah. Anyway,
people that went to
task with the Alter on the surface, if you're a bal nigla, you'll say, well, "That's a nice spiritual statement." Halachically, it's problematic. Okay. The lochain gun. Just like it's an
interesting.
I can't find the sicha.
Yeah.
It's too. Okay.
The lochain. What is specifically that the chepetz is asur?
It's slosh slosh kippus meis. What is slosh slosh kippus meis? Also, midayach itzonim, isn't it? That's what shloshah kipnes is all about.
Mm-hmm. So it's on the article. So.
Yeah.
So he's saying that the
they actually affected the spiritual nature. It's a question.
The question that they could observe.
Oh, that's what I say. The Rebbe Rishab in the middle of saying a mimer, he'd say, and Hamshach from Matzilis, from Ulam Hazar, he'd go with his hand like this. And the Chassidim, who listened to the mimer, were saying, was it he saw what was happening above, and therefore went like that? Or because the Rebbe went like this,
yeah,
it caused it to happen from above? I heard that from the son of one of the rabbis who studied it, the Rebbe Shav, and they argued, he remembers the Bochum arguing this out. So, You know, so here's, so what you said is actually the question here. Did, is it the rabbi saw the changing spiritual current above? Or because of the, or because of the, and they saw that it became usher? Or did they see the changing current above and made it usher? That, you know, we'll leave that for those, for those mystics who, you know, are familiar.
So can we, so are you saying that, that it's kind of getting to the edge, and they're saying before it goes to the edge, we're just going to push it off the edge anyway?
According to, you know, again, if you're, if you're from the point that the rabbi, that this means the rabbi did it, you know, or not, that's true. Okay, so let's cover a little bit more ground. I want to get at least to half of the chapter, or a third of it. So. Look, and God made a covenant tied with Rem Assyrian, who shaved the shaving nuclear. Therefore, the Yetzirah and the power of desire for forbidden things is a demon from Goyish demons. Creates a rash illness of the Gulu. It's the Yetzirah of the worldly nation, Nishvaseihem, Mishloshit with Meis, that their souls come from the three impure creatures. Hashem King Yetzirah of Chachmatav, the Renan Mitzvahim, the Malvus Tevasu, Shed Mishedim Yehudi. But the Yetzirah and the power of desire for permitted things to fulfill your desires. This is a Jewish demon. The fish yochalasuk kedusha kana, because if you do tshuva, the spark of godliness in that, in the kosher food, can return to holiness.
So the yetzer is good with snowball.
There, you have two. You can have two types of yetzer hara. You can have the yetzer hara, which is klipas nogadik, and then the yetzer hara, which is klipas tmeis dik. That's just, I don't want to get into the whole thing, but you say, I'm in Kippur, a chet chatamu b'yetzer hara. Because we forgive, we ask forgiveness for the sin that we sinned with the yetzer hara. What? The sin that we sinned with the yetzer hara? All the sins with the yetzer hara. No. We committed a sin by making the yetzer hara treif. The yetzer hara itself would be just looking for permitted things. Because of our conduct that we made the Yetzer Hara look for other stuff. Anyway, Ahmikom Akom Kogim Shechazel Tshuva, before a person, Shechazel Tushah, before a person, before the godly spark returned to holiness to Tshuva, who Sitra Achon Lakripa. It's Sitra Achon Lakripa, because that, it's a physical thing. Give me a second, we'll cover a little bit of ground, and then we'll get back to the questions. Gama Fakka Chalashimu Menon Nisha Dovah Pagut. Afterwards, the trace from this, from the fact that a person ate the kosher food with a selfish intent, remains in the body. Why? Leos can call Michael Mashka Nasa take of Dom sorrow to sorrow. Because from every food and drink becomes transformed to blood and meat from a person's body. Therefore, the body needs blows in the grave. To purify it from the impurity which it received from satisfaction in this world and its pleasures from Klipas Noga and Jewish demons. Now, I don't know what blows in the grave is. There are texts of Musar and Kabbalah which go into this. I never looked at them, so you have to forgive me. But apparently, the idea is, this is, you know, brought down in certain in texts, that the body, even after the soul departs from it, still is connected to the soul in a certain way. And one of the ways of purifying the soul is by inflicting pain on the body. I just recently had to write a thing on cremation for somebody, and somebody asked for it. And there was a lot of emphasis on the interrelation Kabbalistically between the body after the soul's passing and the soul. And the horror, You know, there was one of these Kabbalists was like, can you imagine the horror of the soul? He was like, you know, in cremation. So, as the body is being, is decomposing in the grave, what happens to it is purification of the soul. There's actually, there's stories that Sadiqim, their bodies remain whole. They dug up, you know, Uri will tell you the story which he heard from the first-hand person who was there. They dug up the Rebbe Rishab's, where it was buried in the old cemetery in Israel. And the communists were destroying the cemetery. And so the Chassidim stole into the cemetery to move the Rebbe's remains. And the body was what, this was like, you know, 30, 40 years afterwards, and the body was entirely whole.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
They picked up the body, they had to move it.
Oh, they just didn't move the grave.
How can you say, how can you move a grave? You know, they move the body.
Mm-hmm. And there's no coffin?
We don't bury anything.
Maybe the
If we can, we don't.
Really?
Yeah.
Without a coffin?
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
Oh, you just... You have turned into the talus, right?
Excuse me?
But you are...
Talus.
You have to cover it and...
Cover it.
Yeah. So,
yeah, footbars look very like a cheap box.
No, well, America is the law, yeah.
So, if you ever watch, hope nobody's part of it, you ever watch what they do is they pay off the things and you see them gather on the grave, they take the body out of the box, and then they put the, and then take off the bottom and put the box over it. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you can't do that, and I'm, you know, if, you know, as long as the box has holes in it, it's okay, halakhically. And it does. You know, they, every box has two holes, you know, so that halakhically, you know, the body is in contact with the ground, it's okay. But the Chassidim are very careful, they take it. You know, this is one of the things that the Kedusha always does. They, you know, the Chassidim surround, there's nobody up on the outside from the door, the body's taken out of the grave, put the rest in contact with the ground, and then the box is put on top of it. Okay. This is, now, and he gives an example. This is El except for a person who never benefited from this world, like Rabbeinu HaKadosh refers to Yudha Nasi. Now, this is one of the, like, I look at this. This, and it's like an awesome point. The Gemara says, before he passed away, Yehuda Nasi stuck up his finger and said, I haven't had a pinky full of benefit from this physical world. Another Gemara says that Yehuda Nasi, we have this it's actually in Rashi, in Rashi's commentary on Chumash, it says Shnei Goyim Mevitnech. You have two nations in your womb. Don't reach Shnei Goyim. Two nations reach Shnei Geyim. Two proud leaders, Yehuda Nasi and Antoninus. That Yehuda Nasi was parallel in wealth and in power to the Roman Caesar. And the Gemara continues, says, he had all the delicacies that the Roman Caesar had at his table, or Yehuda Nasi had at his table. Summer, winter, spring, or fall. Now, wait a second. Had all the delicacies that the Roman Caesar had at his table, and yet I didn't benefit from this world to pick you for. So Tosfos, it's a very misnomer, Tosfos. Tosfos says, they were on his table, we didn't eat it. Yeah. It's a misnomer, Tosfos. How does the Siddhis touch that? He ate it. But it wasn't worldly. When Yehuda Nasi ate it, he was focusing on the godly spark that's there. He wasn't tasting the food as food. He was tasting the food as an expression of the godly spark. Didn't mean he didn't eat the food. He didn't taste the food. But it meant that he wasn't at all in contact with the food as a physical, as merely a physical entity. In other words, this is one of this expression in the verse in Tilden that says, Tzadik ochel esol v'nafsho. The tzadik eats for the satisfaction of his soul. Most of us eat for the satisfaction of our bodies. You know, let's be honest with ourselves.
This was a very good dinner.
A tzaddik, and therefore, as a, you know, on the contrary, there's a whole thrust, even in Judaism, and definitely in other, you know, quote, spiritual movements, towards asceticism. Not to eat, because, hey, you're eating for your body, that's physical. Okay, so, most normative Judaism says, no, that's not... You're not getting stuck in the physical. You're using the physical as a tool. So, use it as a tool. Benefit from the energy that you're getting. Don't deny yourself. Use it. But it's still physical. Tzaddik doesn't work that way. For a tzaddik, it's not physical. A Yehuda Nasi says it's not a thinking tool. He had all the delicacies. He had all the delicacies. And he sensed the godliness in every one of them.
So why couldn't you sense godliness from food that was
impure? Excuse me?
Why does food have to be so impressive? Why couldn't you sense godliness in something inferior?
First of all, he could have. But, you know, Who's wealth and luxury for? The goyim? Not for us? Why shouldn't we all have roast duck every night? Or whatever other delicacy. Or filet mignon is not, you know, whatever. Why shouldn't? Who's going to have who is the luxury for? If not for a tzaddik. Obviously, if you don't have the roast duck and you have to eat simple potatoes, you're also there. But somebody in this world has to elevate the sparks in the roast duck. And I wish everybody the blessing that we all have the means to do so. That was good. One of the first years of the years that Rebbe gave a whole sicha. What a challenge wealth is. How difficult it is to carry on your Yiddishkeit when you're wealthy. The nature of the world is so much different. And after the sicha, he says, and which one of you wanted to be wealthy? The three chassidim stuck their hands up like this. One of them looked like this. So the three who went like that are hugely wealthy. The guy went like this is it's pretty good, but not me. And the Rebbe yelled at us to see him the next week. He says, you all come to me year, day after day, week after week, asking for a brother and panasa. I gave you, yes, of course, I had to make it, there was a choice in the matter. But I gave you the opportunity, and you had three and a half guys wanted it. It was good. What? Who are the people? No.
Is
I wasn't. What? Yeah, they were huge.